Good afternoon. All these jokes about getting old, I'm getting a bit sensitive to it. Then I come in here and see they sit the class of 50 right across the aisle from the really old folks from YVA. We don't have far to go. It's a privilege to be with you this morning and to come home. Judy and I left Southern California early yesterday morning, U.S. Airways flight to Phoenix, then from Phoenix direct up to Spokane. Don't know that I've ever flown that route before, and I was busy at work. For anybody who thinks America's crowded, you fly from Phoenix to Spokane, and there's not much out there. You can see the Grand Canyon as you go by and a few other things. And then finally the pilot says, and now we're starting to descend to Spokane. So I closed up my laptop and looked out the window and down at Lewiston and Clarkston, as sure as you can see. The river is flowing through, and I said, I'm home. And I tracked on up as we went up across the country. Could pick out Colfax and Pullman, Moscow off in the distance. And all the harvest fields, manicured harvest fields across the Palouse Hills, Steptoe Butte. As I looked down at that, I got homesick. I could literally smell the harvest dust. Could feel the sweat off my brow, could feel the hot sun beating on my back from days of driving combine and working out in those fields. We came out last evening, but I couldn't see much then. This morning we came out early and wandered around the campus. The old airstrip is still there where I learned to fly. Many of the buildings have changed, but it's still Spangle. It's still UCA. I grew up in the little town of Troy, Idaho, and some years ago when I was a young faculty member at Loma Linda, one of my colleagues, Kay Kuzma, was writing a book. I don't remember for sure the title, but it was something to the effect of How the Twig Was Bent, and asked if I would contribute a chapter to that book. So I did. I was glad to. And talked about the wonders of growing up and the child incubator, I called it, of Troy, Idaho. I don't remember for sure, 60, 65 members of our church, little two-room church school. Two-thirds of the church were related. Church set up a ski tow every winter out on the hill, and we skied to our heart's content. Wonderful background. Got kicked out of school once when I had a snowball that was too perfect to waste at the end of recess, and it ended up somehow on the backside of our teacher. But a wonderful place to grow up. And then several years ago, one Sabbath morning early as I was hiking up Pisgah Peak near where we live in the hills above Loma Linda, I bumped into an old acquaintance, friend from Troy, up on the trail, and we were chatting, recalling the old days. Then she turned and says, Dick, you know, that's not the way I remember it. Those were some of the toughest years of my life. Really? Yeah. You see, we weren't part of the in crowd. We weren't related to all the rest of you. We were poor. Our house didn't have indoor plumbing. We struggled. And we felt isolated. I walked on down Pisgah that morning with a heavy heart, with a sense of guilt. How could I have missed that? How could I have not sensed the isolation of somebody I went to school with clear back then? And it's out of those hills and valleys and towns of the Northwest that this academy populates its students. We come, young to be sure, too young, some would argue, and we make up the classes at UCA. We learn new social skills. We're placed in challenging situations. And by virtue of our genetics or our environment or our parents, some of us thrive and some of us don't. How do you make a school have the right balance? What is the balance between acceptance, between distinctiveness versus inclusion? The balance between preparation versus separation. We met a lot of new teachers when we came. Most of us came out of a place where teachers were not common. Some of them are here. Ted Lutz running the furniture factory, which is now gone. Harold Oakes teaching us biology and history. Bob Ludeman exposing us to the wonders of the slide rule. I remember walking away from algebra class. There's hardly a problem in the world that slide rule can't fix. Dad Wisby in the dorm, Mom Wisby down at the kitchen, Bob Freitas teaching woodworking. Still have that shoeshine kit sitting in the corner of my closet, still being used. And many others, Warren Dick, George Crumley, I can go on and on. Don Latcha, teaching us band, teaching me to fly. Lynn Wickham, running the choir. All the band trips, all the choir trips, all the fun stuff we did. And yet out of that entire milieu, the question still rises, is this the best place for everyone? And how do we make that kind of a place occur? If you look at education in the Adventist Church, in 1872, we had our first school. Three teachers, 90 students. When we graduated in 1962, 90 years later, the Adventist Church had nearly 5,000 schools scattered around the world, 14,000 teachers, and 330,000 students. Today, nearly 8,000 schools, 94,000 teachers, 112 colleges and universities, and 1.7 million students attending Adventist schools. That's quite an accomplishment for any organization, and certainly for an organization the size of the Adventist Church. Impressive. We're up to 5 medical schools now somewhere in the world. That's the good news. But there's some not so good news as well, because you see, most of that growth is not occurring in this country. It's occurring in what I like to call the majority world, the developing countries of the world. That's where the church is thriving today. But indeed, here in North America, times are tougher. In the Pacific Union, just saw an article recently, a 10% reduction in church school attendance over the past 10 years. A number of academies have closed across this country. A number of elementary schools have closed across this country. The dynamics of the church is changing. And how do we respond to that? Why is that happening? Is education not valued? I don't think so. But the demographics of the Adventist Church are significantly shifting to where Adventist schools do not carry the center spot that they used to. It's a delight to have this school be an exception to those trends. Although even here, if I remember right, and I think I do, we were hitting around 300 students when our class was here 50 years ago. And now we're at, what did I hear, 270 or something. What is it about Christian education that makes it so powerful, so valuable? Some would argue that it's a place to find a spouse. A number of us can vouch for that. Is a place to solidify your values. My wife in the class of 61 and several of her colleagues, Jay Magnuson and Nadine Dower, are working on their memory book. Long phone calls, tracking people down. And I over-listen on occasion. Some of them delighted, warm memories. Others of them not so delighted, struggling, not sure they want to be part of a memory book. How do we create an environment in this church that moves us to the process of inclusion, of acceptance of everyone? Because surely that's what church is all about. We've had a renewed discussion in the church over the last few years about the 28 fundamentals and whether we need to help rewrite the book of Genesis or have a comment on who God calls to the ministry. I would suggest that there are more important issues for the church to address today. That indeed we are a movement at a time that God is calling us to a special place. I want to share a story that began in a small town. A young family, three kids, two girls and a boy. Growing up in the church, active, participating in the various activities that went on. Mom and dad were proud of their kids, watched them develop. And as they grew, it soon became evident that the youngest daughter was going to be one of those uniquely beautiful young women that turns everyone's eyes. I'm the father of three daughters, so I know the risk that means. And so that young father watched with both pride and concern as his children grew. The years went by. They became teenagers. And then one day, it happened. The mom heard about it first down at the market. The father heard about it as he came back in from the fields. Their daughter, their beautiful young daughter, had been caught in adultery. What do you do in a situation like that? When the family gathered that evening, no one spoke. It was a quiet supper. Mom and dad went to bed but didn't sleep. Finally started talking. What do you do when your daughter is in this situation? Morning came. They knew they had to talk about it. Finally was able to bring it up. The young daughter was so apologetic, so sorrowful. It'll never happen again. I'm so sorry. And they tried to put their lives back together. But you know how it is in a small church. The rumor spread. The word went out. Some started shunning the family. A few days went by. A few weeks went by. Life seemed to kind of settle back to normal again. The school board, when they heard about it, of course, called a meeting fairly quickly. It was a long meeting that evening, not because the outcome was in doubt. After all, we have to maintain standards. But because the board struggled with what it meant to this family. The months went by, and then it happened again. And again. And over the following few years, their daughter, their beautiful young daughter, became known as a local prostitute. And the family continued to struggle with that. Finally made a difficult decision for them that perhaps the best thing would be for her to move away, to go to a far town where some relatives lived and try to start her life again. And so she packed up her few belongings and moved down the road, determined to straighten her life out, determined to follow what she had been taught. Found a place to stay, got a job, settled into the new town. And the months went by, and then some travelers from her past came through. The story spread. And pretty soon she was caught back into her life of prostitution again. One day in that town, she heard there was a traveling evangelist coming. And more out of curiosity than anything else, she went down to listen to this guy. Kind of lingered on the edge of the crowd, listened to him speak. And it was there in the city of Magdala that Mary first met Jesus. And you know the story, how her accusers started pointing out her faults to that traveling evangelist. And Jesus quietly bent over and wrote their history in the sand. And one by one they left. I've often wondered what went through Christ's mind. Was he worried about purity in the church? Was he guarding our standards? The next we hear of Mary, she shows up at Simon's party. Came in the back door. She wasn't let in the front door. And you know the story. Broken her, bought in special perfume, anointed Christ's feet. But she'd forgotten one thing. Perfume smells. And pretty soon the whole room turned and knew what had happened. And Simon looked at Christ, and you could see in his mind, how in the world could this guy let this lady do this to her? Bible scholars suggest that Simon may indeed have been Mary's uncle and may indeed have been one of the ones that led her into prostitution in the first place. As Christ perceived Simon's thoughts, he didn't do what I would have done, I can tell you. What a time I would have liked to blast somebody like that. You hypocrite. How can you even do this? But Christ gently said, Simon, if someone owes 500 denarii and someone owes 50 and they're both forgiven, who will love the most? And Simon knew that Christ knew. We next see Mary at the crucifixion day when she and the other women gathered around the cross, the disciples afraid, scattered. They ministered to Christ, and then Sunday morning early, she was the first to the tomb. Found it empty, wondered what had happened, saw the stone rolled back, and was preparing to leave when she saw the gardener standing there and said, "Sir, please, where have they taken him?" And Christ said, "Mary." The traditional translation we all use, that "Mary, please don't touch me because I have not yet gone to my Father," is probably not accurate. The more accurate version says, "Mary, please don't keep on hanging on to me, for I have not yet ascended to my Father." And so we have this picture of Mary, the village prostitute, clinging to the feet of Christ, the one person on earth that had accepted her through everything. Mary, the frequent failure, the condemned sinner, being the first in the world to know of Christ's resurrection. See, that's the kind of God we have. A God of acceptance, a God of inclusion, a God that brings all to Him. So this morning, my challenge to you is, where will this church go? Where will this school go? It's been said the only thing certain about the future is that it lies ahead. Or as Yogi Berra, America's psychologist, said, "When you come to a fork in the road, take it." Which fork will we take? This has the potential for being our finest hour or our biggest challenge. As you know, we run the Adventist Health Study Loma Linda. And as we started AHS2, as we call it, recently, a few years ago, enrolling new people, we discovered that about half the addresses that we mailed to, that the list we'd been given by the churches across this country, were returned, undeliverable. May have moved without changing their address, may have dropped out of church, it's hard to know, undeliverable. In the clinical world that I spend most of my life, we used to talk about making diagnoses and all the things we did, imaging, lab tests, and all that sort of stuff. But the new language today is outcomes. The issue isn't how many tests did you do. The issue is, what was the result? Is the patient doing better? And that sidesteps the whole question of tests, doctor skills, and other things. What is the outcome? I would like to suggest this morning that the time has come for this church to assess its outcomes. What have we produced? What have 27 fundamental beliefs produced? They've certainly given us an understanding, a core knowledge, and now it's time to look at the outcomes. To reach out to be a place where indeed this church opens its arms to all who are hurting. That provides relief of suffering that this world so desperately needs. I want to close by sharing a short poem, a satire. on how we live our lives today. It's entitled $3 Worth of God. It says, I would like to buy just $3 worth of God, please. Not enough to explode my soul or disturb my sleep, but just enough to equal a cup of warm milk or a snooze in the sunshine. I don't want enough of him to make me love an alcoholic or pick beats with a migrant. I want ecstasy, not transformation. I want the warmth of the womb, not a new birth. I want a pound of the eternal in a paper sack. I would like to buy just $3 worth of God, please. Is that what we're doing? Does this church have in its heart, in its soul, the ability to truly demonstrate the outcomes of our great understanding of God and his role in this world? Or have we been so flawed by the genetic pool that we come from and the world we grew up in that it's no longer possible? I would like to believe that indeed God has called us to provide a living demonstration of his compassion, his caring, in a way that this world has waited thousands of years for, and the time has come. I will be forever grateful for this school. And for all the schools across this country and around the world that instill those values in our young people. And my goal indeed, my belief in the future, that our time is now to respond to that call and serve him. May God bless.